Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Pluto TV is the new leading free streaming television service. Watch over 100 TV channels, thousands of movies on demand, all for free. There's no credit card needed, no sign-up required. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. So what are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Pluto TV is free on all your favorite devices. Download Pluto TV today.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
For many years, people have wanted the proper wall, and we have a wall that the likes of which very few places have ever seen. This is going to be close to 500 miles by the time we finish. Those are the areas that are most important. The wall is 30 feet high. We also have 18-foot wall. We have a combination of 30 feet and 18, depending on the area, depending on the importance. Tijuana is right over here. There are thousands of people over there that had been trying to get in. Tremendous cooperation from Mexico, and the president of Mexico has been fantastic. All of Mexico has been fantastic. Now, the wall still obviously has a ways to go, but we're building it at a breakneck speed.
The president yesterday visiting the newly constructed border wall, and he's very proud of that. He was ridiculed, of course, predictably on MSNBC for even talking about the wall, building the wall. It's a waste of money. It's medieval. We have fewer border crossings now than we've had in, I don't know, how long. I mean, they're just going on and on and on about it because they want open borders. The same time we heard that Mexico found 29 plastic bags with body parts in them. People hung over bridges. This huge story today. Sarah Carter had a great posting about it. It is the gang cartel violence, territorial disputes are terrifying in Mexico. But we are getting more cooperation. And the man who really is emerging as the president's voice on immigration is Ken Cuccinelli. He's an old friend. He's the acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And he joins us now to tell us about yesterday and what's next for our quest to really reform these asylum laws. And he joins us now. Ken, great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm good. It's been a good week out there. So, you know, you point to what the president did. He didn't talk about him signing the wall with a Sharpie.
Oh, that's right. Well, he sounded like such a construction guy out there. You could see
that's where he comes from, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, he seemed he just seemed so at ease, you know, talking about materials and stuff's built.
Look, Laura, I've traveled with him and I've spent time with him, and one thing, you know, it's not so much part of the news, but, you know, I remember we went down for the 400th anniversary of the Virginia General Assembly, the oldest continuing operating legislature in the country, and I got to ride in the Beast, his limo, and he does stuff like he touched the glass, and you touch this glass that you can see through, and it's like harder than anything you've ever touched. And here's this guy who's been president 2.5 years, and he says, isn't that cool? That is so cool. He's just very, you know, he's very down to earth. He's a rough and tumble guy, as everybody can see, but he has not got a regal bone in his body. And you put him in a construction area, and he's going to be a construction guy, you know, because that's what he did. That's what he's done. He knows it. So
now, tell us.
It's very different from past presidents.
No, that's for sure. And tell us about the big changes that, again, don't get the publicity that frankly they deserve, and that are having a day-to-day positive impact on what was previously a crush of family units at the border. Tell us specifically what the Trump administration, just with its own executive authority, has been able to do.
Well, the president has been extremely clear on how aggressive he wants us all to be to use every legal mechanism available to us. And since I've arrived here at the beginning of June, that's what we've done at USCIS. You've seen it across the Department of Homeland Security. And we have implemented a new and frankly tough rule to block asylum at the southern border. The Supreme Court last week, I know you followed this, let that go into effect, and they blocked the Ninth Circuit attempts at enjoining that, particularly Judge Tiger, a rogue activist judge in the Northern District of California. And that's going to make a continuing forward-looking difference in driving these numbers down. And we're keeping families together now, preparing to do that as part of detention, so they can also be moved back to their home countries expeditiously. All these things happening at the same time. There's no silver bullet, but all of these things, in the complete absence of Congress to act, are having a positive, beneficial effect. And this is all a result of the president's own policies. And the same is true internationally. When you see the cooperation we're getting from Mexico, as tough as some of the things are over there, we're getting more immigration cooperation from Mexico than I ever remember. We're on that same path with Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. You've got recently El Salvador started sending the police to their own border to block migration out of their country, illegal immigrants moving up toward the U.S. And that all of that is happening because this president was willing to take a tough negotiating stance with all these other countries that none of his predecessors, Democrat or Republican, have been willing to do. And you know what the result is, Laura? We're developing better partnerships with these countries in this area than we've ever had. So he's getting it right, he's being aggressive, and we are carrying forward with every single opportunity we can, both domestically and internationally, to stem this crisis. We have a long way to go, but we are on the right path thanks to this president.
The former DHS head, Janet Napolitano, was at one of the Senate hearings last week and spoke out about what should be the right approach at the border. Let's listen.
I think the border, as I said, it's a zone to be managed. It is certainly an area where law enforcement needs to be engaged in terms of drug smuggling and gun smuggling and the like. But what I mean to suggest is that the border itself is not the number one threat to the safety and security of the American people, despite the overwhelming public attention being drawn to the border as the function of DHS.
So it's a zone to be managed.
Well, it's a boundary that defines the edge of the country. So, and we've got such vast numbers coming in, attempting to come in illegally. I would not necessarily agree, but I would make one point that she didn't make there that's worth remembering, and that is that prior to the rush, mad rush on the border we've seen the last couple of years, particularly this year, most people in this country illegally came in legally and have overstayed various visas. And of course, many of them, Laura, as you and I know, never had any intention of abiding by that visa, right? So, so we do, and those people get by the border in apparent compliance with the law and then later break the law. So we still have to have that very robust removal going on by ICE. The more of that can happen, the better, because it also deters other people from coming.
So what happens now when I was down in Eagle Pass in Del Rio in early June, late May, and was able to spend a few days with the Border Patrol teams there and was out at the Rio Grande with them. So I saw what was happening firsthand and talked to a lot of the migrants, and Spanish is okay, so I could kind of converse with them. So it was fascinating to be there. But what happens now when an adult and a child appear or come across the Rio Grande or picked up by Border Patrol? Are they being sent back to Mexico to await their asylum hearing immediately? Is that happening yet?
That is happening, and I was just down in Laredo on the border earlier this week with the Secretary, Mark Morgan, head of CBP, and Matt Albans, head of ICE, and we walked through the court facilities right there at the port of entry, literally on the border, where the hearings that the kind of people you just described would come back for, but We have 45,000 of those people now waiting in Mexico for their hearings. So instead of coming into the U.S. and either being released or even being detained in the U.S., they're having to wait in Mexico. This is the greatest fruit, I think, of the partnership with Mexico thus far, alongside their own increase in their own internal enforcement, which benefits us as well. That's how that's working. And it has really expanded massively our family holding capacity. So you keep these families together, but you keep them in detention when they come in illegally.
Who is, I'm looking at this piece in BuzzFeed News where it says, Ken Cuccinelli wants the power to reveal the personal information of refugees and asylees who are accused of crimes. And they somehow got their hands over at BuzzFeed on an internal memo signed by you on September 10th. Who the hell is leaking information to BuzzFeed over there?
That's a good question, Laura. That's a very good question. Yeah, if I had the answer
disturbing.
To it, I'd have already acted on it.
Yeah, but how many people had access to the memo? I mean, that's probably a lot of people.
Right. When it goes from us up to DHS front office, we lose sight of it. So, you know, we don't have eyes into who and how many people have it up there either. So I can do an easier job of tracking it in my own agency. But and the underlying policy there is, look, you got people accused of crimes, and in the midst of a debate about immigration and asylum and refugees and so forth, sharing with the American people the immigration history of accused criminals seems very reasonable.
Yeah, why is that? Why is this even a controversy? Yeah, why is this even an issue? I mean, I saw this and I'm like, I should hope we're doing this.
Exactly. And the problem now is it takes too long because of the sort of arduous process in place. And what we're trying to do is, in these select number of cases, we're not just opening up these people's files. We're opening up the files of people credibly accused of crimes in this country. And we have a greater the immigration system is supposed to be for Americans. And when you have a situation like someone who's come into this country who then commits other crimes, Americans have the right to know how they got here and what were the circumstances of their entry and all those sorts of things. In the event, they'd like to talk to their elected officials about changing all of that.
Well, again, I think part of the confusion on the border issues, Ken, is that a lot of Americans don't really understand the flow of criminality across the border, and they think it's just, you know, a poor mother and her child, and people's hearts break, and I understand that, and we all want people to have a better, and safer life in their home countries, but this is a cartel in human trafficking disaster at the border, and
we have to look at it from the southern side. We look from our side. If you look from the southern side, north of the border, what you see is a big toll booth for the drug cartels in the northern part of the country. In particular, they get a cut of about 60% or 2/3 of all of the human smuggling going on across that border. They're making hundreds of millions of dollars off of this, and Congress continues to fail to help close the loopholes that are making our job more difficult and driving this wave of illegal immigration.
Yeah, I mean, and they're making huge amounts of money over it. But I never cease to be amazed, though, that when common sense proposals, such as what you're suggesting in this memo, are leaked internally by people who are clearly working against administration policy from within. That is really disturbing to me. And the administration has suffered from.
You can imagine
leaks.
How disturbing it is
yeah.
to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd be livid. But again, the underlying issue is, I mean, totally common sense. So, I mean, it's not like a big deal. I mean, I kept thinking to myself, I can't believe this isn't already done. So it's just the fact that someone's leaking anything. It's just infuriating.
It is. It's not a fact of life around here, but it is something we pay attention to. We've dealt with it in other circumstances. We've dealt with at least the number that comes to mind, 27 others in my time here, quietly and internally. They're personnel matters. So, and we continue to deal with some others on an ongoing basis, and we'll keep doing that.
I want to remind everyone before we let you go about where the Democrat candidates are on the issue of the border. Elizabeth Warren, back in July, made her point clear in a Q&A in a lefty California podcast. Let's listen.
Quick yes or no, repealing 1325 of immigration. Are you in favor of that?
So I am. I think that the whole notion of criminalizing the approach to coming across the border without documentation is not making anybody any safer, and that we just need to be in a different position on this.
That's basically the litmus test now for the Democrats. Are you in favor of basically repealing the section of the immigration code that makes it a, well, it's kind of a civil violation, but it is against the law?
Well, no, it's criminal to enter illegally. It is a criminal violation. It is not a criminal violation to overstay a visa as a policy matter.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem, particularly in those instances, and admittedly rare, when we can demonstrate that people intended all along not to abide by the terms of their visas. The policy answer isn't to decriminalize illegal entry into this country. The policy answer in that limited space is to equate overstaying a visa with entering illegally and make it a crime as well and treat it as a crime.
Well, we have 666,000 people. Is that figure right, who overstayed just last year?
I don't know about that specific number for last year, but it would not surprise me. Again, historically, overstaying of visas is how, or jumping a visa, if you will, is traditionally, for a number of years, been the number one way illegals enter this country.
Yeah, well, again, the 9/11 Commission said we should have biometric entry exit tracking people easily.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that should
you and I talked before, Laura. I'm a privacy nut when it comes to U.S. citizens, but if other people want to come in our country, we should take every available step to protect ourselves and to control the information related to those people. So they should have to do biometric entry and biometric exit so we can keep track of the non-Americans who are here.
Make sure to write a memo about that. Attach the 9/11 Commission document and then leak it yourself.
Upcoming leak, right?
Yeah, just leak it yourself before you send it on. Ken Cuccinelli, hey, thanks for what you're doing out there. You're doing a great job, and I know the president.
Thanks, Laura. Appreciate it.
Loves the fact that you're on the team and doing such a great job. Ken Cuccinelli's been on this issue for decades, frankly. He knows so much about it. Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of our sponsors, including ADT Home Security and Janusel, Pluto TV, among others. They help provide this podcast to you free every week. We support them because they support you. They say that home is where the heart is. Well, the reality is that home is where all of your precious belongings are located, where your family lives. So don't you want to protect your most precious investment? So go with the nation's number one smart home security provider, ADT. They provide everything from video doorbells, indoor and outdoor cameras, smart locks and lights, all controlled from the ADT app or the sound of your voice. So peace of mind, priceless. So get a custom designed ADT home security system connected to first responders installed in your home today. Safety, security and protection are just a click away. Visit ADT.com. That's ADT.com.
Virtually every top Democrat also now supports taxpayer-funded abortion right up to the moment of birth, ripping babies straight from the mother's womb. Leading Democrats have even opposed measures to prevent the execution of children after birth. You saw that in Virginia. Republicans believe that every life is a sacred gift from God.
Trump has just done an unbelievable I mean, an unbelievable job on the pro-life issue. Just incredible. I mean, just an absolute incredible job. He's been very clear since the campaign and the debates with Hillary. And what he said was prescient. Like, you think they could be killed up to the moment of birth, but it was even worse after birth, which is what we saw with that New York measure that was passed, clear infanticide, supporting that in the third trimester, and also the Ralph Northam cold and frankly just evil comments about, oh, well, would keep the baby comfortable before we kill it. So, I mean, people who, you know, most Americans, I think, still in the polls believe that, you know, first trimester abortions are, you know, they're not preferable, but they don't want to criminalize them. But when you get past that first trimester, that's when the public opinion really switches. So it's just beyond upsetting. Beyond upsetting. But the president was just great. This is back in June of this year. And now we find out that this twisted sick abortion doctor in South Bend, Indiana, actually had the human remains of up to 2,000 aborted fetuses in his home. Just to refresh your memory, if you didn't follow this story. On Friday, officials in South Bend, Indiana, found at the home of this now deceased abortionist, Ulrich Klopfer. He worked at this big abortuary in South Bend, Indiana. That's where Mayor Pete Zemmour worked there for decades. He somehow brought the fetal remains home. 2,246 medically preserved aborted fetuses in his Illinois home. Now, if that's not satanic, I don't know what is the definition of evil. Well, this is Hitlerian. He operated three Indiana clinics in South Bend, Fort Wayne, and Gary, Indiana, the last of which closed in 2016 in the midst of state licensing board trial on documentation and reasonable care violations. Now, Pete Buttigieg's campaign ignored questions about this and just tried to stay away from the issue. But finally, he was approached on this issue and finally had to address it. This is what he did.
Like everyone, I find that news out of Illinois extremely disturbing, and I think it's important that be fully investigated. I also hope that it doesn't get caught up in politics at a time when women need access to health care. There's no question that what happened is disturbing. It's unacceptable.
Why is it disturbing? If it's nothing, it's not a human being.
Yeah, he also says it happens in Illinois. He ignores that they operated clinics in his hometown.
Right. Nice try.
You know, there's a lot of parts of the Bible that talk about how life begins with breath. And so even that is something that we can interpret differently. And
I'm pro-choice.
Take up, me too.
Yeah.
And, but I think no matter where you think about the kind of cosmic question of how life begins, most Americans can get on the board with the idea of, all right, I might draw the line here, you might draw the line there, but the most important thing is the person who should be drawing the line is the woman making the decision.
Absolutely.
Well, so the brilliant ethicist at the Breakfast Club radio show. And Pete Buttigieg, by the way, is forever lecturing the rest of us about Christianity and morality. And it's extremely disturbing, the news out of Illinois. The guy operated in Indiana three clinics. He's an extremist on abortion, and this so-called doctor is like Joseph Mengele taking his victims home. And I mean, this guy got some thrill out of killing these little babies. Got some twisted thrill out of it. It's like It's like the mass killers or the killers who would keep their victims in refrigerators. And what's the one I'm thinking about? The famous cannibal.
Was that Jeffrey Dahmer?
Yeah, Dahmer, yeah, who kept things in his refrigerator. That's sick. I mean, I think we've only skimmed the surface of the sick, twisted, demonic a treatment of aborted fetal remains. But the process is sick. What they are doing is sick, and so it begets more sickness. So the underlying conduct is what it is. It's the taking of human life, and so of course it ends up in a horrible place. This is just what's going to happen. Joining us now, I'm delighted he's with us, Congressman Jim Banks, Republican, 3rd District, Indiana. And covering Fort Wayne, of course, which is one of the areas where this Klopfer had a clinic. Congressman, great to have you with us. Your reaction to this, you know, kind of very, I think, dismissive almost response by Buttigieg. I hope this doesn't get caught up in politics. Oh, I bet he hopes. I bet he hopes it doesn't.
Yeah, that's right, Laura. He doesn't want it to be political because, unfortunately for him, this is very political. Because Pete Buttigieg in 2018 vetoed a zoning resolution in South Bend that would have allowed for a pro-life women's health center to set up right next door to the legacy clinic that was operated by the employees of Dr. Klopfer. That's why it is political, because Pete Buttigieg himself denied more options for women in his own community, and now he needs to answer for that.
Well, this individual is no longer with us, Mr. Klopfer, but you're right. I mean, we did this on the Ingram angle. Raymond Arroyo went there and reported on this, is what they did to that pro-life organization. He tried to zone them out of existence. And then a very wealthy family who owned the property across the street basically said, no, we're actually giving you this property. And so it ended up working out for the pro-life folks, but they were originally going to be right next door to the abortuary, correct?
That's right. The pro-life women's healthcare center was going to operate right next door to the abortion clinic that was set up by Dr. Klopfer's former staff. And that's why Pete in 2018 vetoed it right on the eve of becoming a presidential candidate. So it's almost hilarious to me to hear Pete's, even though there's nothing funny about this story, Laura, it's hilarious to hear his response, because it's very much a political situation. Because Pete Buttigieg himself denied women in his own community other options and healthcare options instead of Dr. Klopfer's legacy house of horrors that was operating in his own community.
No. Well, again, the Democrats have become such extremists, Congressman, on so many issues. This is just one of the more graphic representations of their radicalism. And it's found in this, you know, in this horror show, as you said, of a cemetery of aborted babies, and I think there's probably, I don't know, there's probably more legal action to be taken in this case, because obviously there are a lot of people who drop the ball on this,
well,
a lot of individuals.
Yeah, President Trump has agreed with myself and other Indiana lawmakers there should be a federal investigation, because the remains of these babies were carried across state lines. What I would like to know, though, is if some of these employees who are still operating in South Bend had anything to do with the transport of those remains, or anything to do with some of the activities that happened in the past. And that's where Mayor Pete needs to explain himself even more. Why did he veto in 2018 a pro-life women's health care center that would have operated and served women in his own community? That's the real political situation here for Pete that's still gone unanswered.
Let's move on to some other issues, Congressman. I know you're on the Armed Services Committee. Tensions running very high after this series of drone hits on Saudi oil refineries. What is your sense on this ongoing debate about whether Trump's being too weak in his response? Iran says attack us and it's an act of war. Lindsey Graham said we have to do something. I'm with Trump on taking a very cautious approach to more military engagement in the Middle East after what we've seen over the past 16 years.
I served in Afghanistan, Laura. I don't want America to get into another war as well. And that's why I appreciate the president's approach. He's shown remarkable restraint in dealing with Iran. Yes, we need to hold them accountable. And yes, that's exactly what President Trump is doing. The sanctions and the maximum pressure campaign on Iran is working. Their economy is feeling the drastic effects of it today. The oil revenue for Iran is only 10% of what it was before President Trump instituted those sanctions. Their economic growth is negative 12%. Inflation is 40%. Their economy is literally on the brink of collapse. If there ever was an economy in the tank, it's Iran's economy. So I think we're on the right track. The president is ratcheting up those sanctions, and that's going to force Iran into a corner and to come back to the table eventually to negotiate with the U.S. In better faith than the weak approach that President Obama took with the JCPOA.
Well, and I think, again, we see that an America that is strong at home is going to be an America ultimately that is more potent on the international stage. And I think also more influential, contrary to what the Democrats are saying. The Democrats are saying that, oh, look, we're weaker. You know, we're going to rebuild our alliances. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? America has the strongest economy of the G7 by far. And all these other countries just want us to cave to China so they can sell their Mercedes back in, Beijing.
Not to mention, Laura, this is the first time in 75 years because of President Trump's leadership that America is oil independent. We export more oil than we import. And that's why we're not today feeling the effects of the disruption on the international oil markets from these recent Iranian attacks on Saudi oil rigs. So that's the good news. We can withstand this, and we need to hold Iran accountable, but that's exactly what President Trump is doing. More of that, ratcheting up that pressure, and avoiding a war. The American people don't want us to get into another unnecessary war, and President Trump is doing everything that he can to avoid it.
Well, another point that I'm just so grateful that you've made, and you're really a leader on this issue, is calling on the Federal Retirement, the Thrift Investment Board, to prevent investing in the Morgan Stanley All Country World Index, because that's where China's money is. They have a lot of money in that fund. And explain why that would be so important, and also just add to the pressure that we are putting on China at such a critical time in our trading relationship.
Well, this is unbelievable to me to find that our federal workers' pension funds have recently been allowed to be invested in Chinese companies like ZTE, potentially in companies like Huawei, adversarial Chinese companies. But you have federal employees that are dedicating their lives to combating the Chinese threat and their efforts to dominate the United States militarily and economically. And here we go, investing federal pension funds and these Chinese companies. So my legislation, as you mentioned, would reverse that recent decision to allow those funds to be invested there. And I think if we can get the president's attention on that recent ruling by the Thrift Savings Plan, I imagine the president would agree that we should reverse that decision and not allow our pension funds to be invested there.
Yeah, well, they're hurting. You know, they want to get involved in more of the bond fund. They want bond issuance. I have lots of friends on the Hill, I'm sure friends of yours too, told me last night about how China's desperately trying to raise more capital and finance their own projects. And they're trying to raise money and doing bond issuances through U.S. firms. I think all of this is ridiculous that we allow this.
Yeah, if we're serious about combating the Chinese threat, then it's going to take a whole of government approach and prevent, you know, simple issues like this, preventing our pension dollars from supporting these adversarial companies. So we'll keep working on that, but there's a lot more that we can do to, whether restraining Huawei or, you know, the other issues that I'm working on to prevent our universities from giving away in their normal research efforts, giving away secrets to Chinese as well. There's so much more that we can do that we're not doing, but that's what President Trump is focused on as well.
Now, and thank you for everything you've continued to do on this. Congressman, we really appreciate it. Congressman Jim Banks here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. And I want to remind everybody that we only have 2 weeks left for the inventory clearance sale from Chamonix. So right now, when you order the GenuCell jawline treatment, you'll get the classic GenuCell for bags and puffiness free. That's right, you get it free. From Beverly, Huntsville, Alabama, raves about the results she sees with GenuCell. She loves the product. She saw a difference almost immediately. She recommends it to her friends, her family, anyone who, well, might have a little problem or want to deal with the skin on their jawline. Doesn't seem to look like it used to look. And all GenuCell products she uses now and loves them. Well, I second that emotion. So it's time to stock up on the best skincare or try the luxury and effectiveness of the GenuCell at the best prices of the year. And results, remember, are guaranteed or you get 100% of your money back. No questions asked. Order now and you get the legendary collagen builder also free. So go to GenuCell.com. That's GenuCell.com to order. You'll get 3 free gifts with your order. Only 2 weeks left, so order now at GenuCell.com. That's GenuCell.com.
And when you have a very determined minority, in this case, wealthy white men and wealthy white Christian men and Christian Americans who are of the fundamentalist variety, who are very clear that no matter what happens, if they have to pull the South Africa model to maintain power forever, they will do it. And they're not afraid of it, and they're increasingly open about it. And Donald Trump is merely the avatar for this.
I wanted to give this speech right here. And not because of the arch behind me or the president that this square is named for. Nope. We are not here today because of famous arches or famous men. In fact, we're not here because of men at all. We're here because of some hardworking women.
I hit this issue huge on the Ingraham angle, which is this increasingly anti-male sentiment that is ripping through the Democrat Party. I've never seen anything like it. They have half of the country or so are men. And now we're to lead boys to believe that they're the problem, that their testosterone is the problem, that they need to be more feminine or more, you know, more docile, not so assertive, not so competitive, not so aggressive. Oh, that's going to end up in a really good place. A lot of repressed boys. That's going to be great. Alienated and repressed boys. So we talked about this and hit this hard because I think it's, again, another sign of the growing radicalism inside the Democrat Party. And it's a sign that the fringiest of the fringe viewpoints from the universities have now infected the entire Democrat Party. I mean, it used to be just like you hear about these things at a women's studies symposium. Now it's you hear Beto talking about it or Warren. And so this is where we are. So I thought it would be a good time to share my interview I did not so long ago with the 12 Rules author, who's his own international brand for men and common sense thinking, Jordan Peterson. Of course, his book, 12 Rules for Life, the paperback, just coming out, and it was a massive worldwide bestseller. He joins us now to talk about how they're even taking his book out of bookstores in New Zealand because the power of ideas, they're too powerful to in the wrong hands. Or they're toxic themselves, so they have to be removed from the public square, which just diminishes our ability to think and have free debate. He joins us now. Jordan, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thank you for the invitation.
Jordan, let's talk about this socio-political landscape that has developed around us, about language and ideas and how the left, especially, every time there's a tragedy that they can pin on others, more traditional thinkers, they rush in to do that rather than have a debate about the underlying issue.
Well, people want to come up with a solution that's in accordance with what they already believe, because that's cognitively the most straightforward thing to do. I mean, it's the proclivity of people everywhere to use their already formulated ideas whenever they have the opportunity to do so. And then you also pointed out in the intro that the person who perpetrated the massacre in New Zealand had written a manifesto that was specifically aimed at increasing division and this positive feedback loop partisanship that we see emerging in the media and on social media.
Now, what part of this your book is dangerous to their worldview? What specifically about 12 rules for life? That they're pretty basic rules, like make your bed and there's some basic things that were traditional things. They were basic to all of us growing up.
Well, they were designed that way. I mean, when I wrote the rules, I knew perfectly well that they were, in some sense, you might consider them self-evident maxims. And so, of course, that raises the question of why they need to be written about or defended. But I would say in a chaotic time, it's necessary for people to begin to understand consciously what they've always abided by unconsciously. Otherwise, everyone ends up far too confused. I think the fundamental threat that my work poses to the radicals on the left, but also the identitarian types on the right, is that I'm writing about the centrality of the individual, especially in relationship to responsibility rather than rights, let's say, and that I insist on the utility, necessity, inevitability, and functionality of hierarchies, even at the basic level of perception, because it is the case, and I outline this, for example, in chapter 10, which is called Be Precise in Your Speech. You can't look at the world without viewing it through a hierarchy, because you have to organize what's important before you can perceive what's necessary. And so the radical left is very much threatened by the emphasis that I'm placing on the individual as the primary unit of analysis, and by the insistence that I have that hierarchies are not only inevitable, but necessary, crucially necessary. And the breakdown of hierarchy, very, very dangerous thing.
Well, when you see young people, as you probably saw the video, Jordan, of that kid cracking the egg on the head of that right-wing politician in Australia who, I don't know, made some comment that got everyone upset after the Christchurch killing. The kid goes up, he's 17, cracks the egg on his head, and is cracking it on one hand, with one hand, videoing it with a cell phone on the other. The official smashes, cuffs him back, smacks him back, which is, think about this, what my father would have done. He would have backhanded me right in the car as we were driving. So he pushes him back, and then that kid becomes celebrated. He is celebrated globally. You showed him, and kids are speaking to adults in a manner in which I wouldn't have dreamed of speaking to adults. I mean, I still call my neighbors growing up in Connecticut, I still say, Mrs. Johnson and Mr. Kosmeski, and I would never, and they say, oh, call me by my first name. I said, you're 55 years old. No, I'm not going to call you by your first name. You're Mr. That's how we were raised. But now that's all out the window. Speaking of hierarchical problems.
Well, it's part of a continued assault on the idea of value itself, I would say, and on the idea that things have to be organized in terms of the primacy of their importance. I see it as I've explained this in some detail in my first book, Maps of Meaning, and in my lectures, and in this latest book. I see it as a continuation of the destruction of the idea of order itself. I mean, even the mantra of the age, say diversity, inclusivity, equity, is profoundly anti-hierarchical. It couldn't be more anti-hierarchical. And the thing is that hierarchies aren't without their dangers. Anyone sensible understands that, because if a hierarchy is a structure of order, which is certainly one of the things that it is, it can become rigid and it can become dysfunctional in that it no longer performs the operations that it was designed to perform. You know, most of the time what happens, as far as I can tell, is that we as human beings have complex problems to solve because of our fragility. And we organize ourselves into cooperative and competitive hierarchies that are aimed at addressing those problems. That's how a functional society works. And then your position in the hierarchy is a function of your utility with regards to the solution of that particular problem. I mean, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone in some sense. And every business is devoted towards solving a problem, providing a solution. Mm-hmm. You can argue about whether all the solutions are necessary, but that's a free market issue to some degree for that determination to be made. But there's no possibility of organizing ourselves properly and solving those complicated problems without hierarchy. And no one is educated anymore, I would say, to understand why that's not only useful but psychologically necessary for people. We can't survive sanely without order, because everything comes flooding in. That's the thing. When the walls crumble, everything comes flooding in. I would say psychologically that's part of the reason that Trump's message was so attractive to people. The idea of the wall, you know, because, and the idea of the wall is a centrally conservative idea.
Yes.
In the classic sense. And what walls do is separate some things from other things so that everything doesn't blur into one overwhelming chaotic mass. And increasingly, people have the sense that that's what's happening. And so when Trump says something like, well, let's build a wall, it's very, very attractive to the part of the psyche that's overwhelmed by transformation and change that's too rapid.
Too fast.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And too much information as well. Information flow that's too, what would you say? It's transforming at a rate that no one can adapt to.
No, and I think you point out, and it's a very interesting way of looking at it. You point out that we moved for centuries or millennia as in packs. People moved in packs, family packs. There were multiple families moving together. And a hierarchy naturally develops through strength and skill. Certain people have skills in sewing. Others have skills in hunting. Others have brain power that can see enemies in the distance. That develops over long expanses of time, and it only became clear like why this was happening when we developed further as human beings. Like why did this all work? We never even thought about it, and then it became instinct for us to live this way. But today, with the rise of social media and the blurring of the lines between, I think, adults and children, which adults want to be infants their whole entire lives, they want to be infantilized, and children want to be adults. Like, it's a crazy dynamic we have now. Now we're having the push for, oh, egalitarianism. It's all the, everyone's going to be equal. We're going to have an equal standard of living, equal salaries. It's going to be free college, free pre-K, free universal pre-K, free healthcare. Everyone's going to be equal. But then no one ever is really going to emerge equally at the same time. That never could happen. It hasn't happened through human history. But somehow they think it's going to work now.
Well, you know, the desire for a certain degree of equality is part of standard morality, let's say. You know, it's not like anyone regardless of their political position, is pleased emotionally when they walk down the street and they see someone who's devastated and alcoholic and homeless. You know, it produces a pang in the soul of anyone with a conscience. And the attendant desire, at least from the perspective of compassion, to have a society organized so that such things don't occur. That's the emotional driver for that egalitarian vision. The problem is that egalitarian compassion alone is of insufficient sophistication to build a complex functional society. You need compassion and mercy, but you need justice and order as well. And those are of equal import, and they fight in some sense across mm-hmm. historical spans of time for predominance. You know, you want justice tempered with mercy, but by the same token, as we already discussed, without a hierarchy, you can't even perceive the world, and you can't organize yourself, to, especially in groups, to do anything of any utility. And the radical postmodernists in particular, in their strange association with the radical leftists, insist that every hierarchical structure is composed of nothing but the expression of raw power. And that's unbelievably pernicious because it destroys the idea of competence and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, there's multiple problems with that. One is that, well, you're flooded, as I said before, by too much of everything. But you also have no goal anymore. You know, you said that children want to be adults, or at least they want to have the, let's say, the privileges of adults, and that adults want to be children. And I think that young people are having a hard time deciding that growing up is worthwhile, because if you destroy the idea of a hierarchy of order, you destroy the idea that maturity is possible and valuable.
Mm.
That functional maturity and competence itself is desirable. And so if the hierarchy is flattened and there's no up, there's no impetus for forward movement. And it's even worse than that, you know, psychologically mm-hmm. speaking, because if there's no impetus towards forward movement because nothing is more valuable than anything else, then there's no positive emotion, you see, because we're biologically constructed so that we experience a sense of engagement in the world when we see ourselves successfully pursuing a valued goal. And that assumes we have valued goals, and that assumes that we have a hierarchy.
Well, that's why nationalism, it properly understood, nationalism meaning love of country, not perverted nationalism to indicate oppression and subjugation, but nationalism meaning love of country, like you love your nation. That's what, when real we love our nation, we want to work with other countries, but we love our country. Love of country subverted by individual groups that say, okay, standing for the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, you're agreeing with the patriarchy. They do this to you, Jordan, when you go speak, as I saw that protester in Melbourne. And we're going to play this soundbite. They seek out individuals to brand them as part of the social unfairness that's pervasive because of this hierarchical structure that they want to destroy. Let's listen.
Push is always there to confront any far right or fascist presence. Now, Jordan Peterson is really just part of that far right that's there to pump out the misogyny and the homophobia and the racism and the transphobia,
blah, blah, blah,
that we're very well aware of. But their whole purpose in coming on these tours of Australia is to build a global far-right movement. So this is why we have to be there every time.
So, Jordan, you're working on building that global – you sound pretty mild-mannered to me. I don't know. You said – building that global far-right movement of this crazy idea of individual liberty and freedom and free thought and free expression. It's very dangerous.
Well, it's mostly, and this is the crucial issue, and I think this is what separates my thinking in some sense and what I'm doing from, well, from whatever might be comparable or conceivably comparable, is that the individuality that I'm stressing is conceptual first. So the idea is that the primary lens through which another should be viewed is the lens of individuality. And the second element is that I'm speaking primarily about individual responsibility, not individual rights. And so this isn't it has nothing to do with the right wing in a political sense. It has nothing to do with the left wing in a political sense either, because right. It's not a political idea. The idea is that it's a psychological idea, and the idea is that your best bet with regards to contending with the tragedy of the world without becoming bitter and hurt and vengeful is to adopt a responsible stance towards being and to tell the truth and to act courageously and to extend that responsibility to your family and your community. You know, and nationalism, the nationalism that you referred to in its positive aspect, is the extension of that responsibility to the community.
To each other.
It's also predicated on the idea that your community can't be infinitely large in scope. And that's the Tower of Babel problem, I would say, fundamentally, is that, and this is exactly what's plaguing the European Economic Union, is that as the scale of the collective enterprise expands, the distance between the individual citizens and the people who are the elites, as you call them, grows necessarily. So it's a problem of hierarchy, perversely enough, even though it's something that's supported by the left. People feel that once their groups have gone beyond a certain size, that there's nothing about them that constitutes a collective project, and that they have no voice or influence in that process. And so they become alienated. And that's when fragmentation begins to occur. You can't be powerless. You can't be without influence in the group you identify with, because otherwise it's not your group. It's like you're not on the team. You're not playing the game. The game isn't even on anymore. And the people who are opposed to national borders, let's say, don't understand that the demolition of the local will produce much larger, much
chaos,
more rigid, and much less responsive hierarchies.
I want to play something for you, Jordan, about, and this cuts right into what you're talking about with how people are trying to find their own identity or group that they can have influence in, and I think it also addresses this issue of the perpetual. We're all infants. I mean, no one wants to stand up and take personal responsibility for his or her actions or life when it's much easier to blame some other collective or other individual for your problems. Some people blame mommy and daddy, spend their whole life talking about mommy and daddy did this to me and my mommy and daddy did. Okay. All right. Now what are you going to do? All right. And then there's another issue, and that's that issue of privilege that Ocasio-Cortez talks about. Let's listen.
Almost every single person in this country can acknowledge some privilege of some type. You
right.
know, I'm a cisgendered woman. I will never know the trauma of feeling like I'm not born in the right body. Mm-hmm. And that is a privilege that I have, mm-hmm. no matter how poor my family was when I was born. But it's really hard for some people to admit.
Well, she's basically saying that people are different. And so if you're different, then everybody has privilege. Take it away from the cisgender
thing. It's a dangerous and vacuous statement. And the reason that it's vacuous is the reason that you just pointed out, which is that we're all positioned in the world differently. And so we have a different range of, let's call them, opportunities and obstacles that confront us on a day-to-day and month-to-month basis. And so it's self-evident. But the dangerous part of that is, you see, this is one of the things I started to understand as I took apart what happened after the Russian Revolution and why it went so terribly wrong. You see, if you can identify dimensions of privilege, let's say that those would be associated with group identity, right? They frequently are. Dimensions of privilege. She talked about being cisgendered, for example, which, by the way, is a term I absolutely despise. But you can take apart everyone and you can find one dimension, and this is exactly what she says, you can find one dimension at least along which everyone has been unfairly advantaged by the past for some reason. And then, so that's one thing. But the next thing is then if you believe in radical equality of outcome as your goal, then all of that unfair privilege has to be eradicated. And what happens is that the privilege isn't eradicated. It's the people with the privilege that end up eradicated. And it's so dangerous because, I mean, it's so comical to hear Ocasio-Cortez point this out. She said, well, everyone has undeserved privilege. It's like, okay, well, if we're going to get rid of undeserved privilege, then well, what does that mean if everyone has it? And the proper response to that, as far as I'm concerned, is to be grateful for what you have and to bear your, what would you call it, to bear your inequalities with dignity, but to act responsibly as an individual agent. This is what the West figured out thousands of years ago, I would say, is that, of course, life is arbitrary and unfair. Obviously, there's nothing more obvious than that. So what do you do about that? And the answer is, well, you try to gratefully utilize your arbitrary talents in a manner that's beneficial, and you try to bear your unfair suffering with dignity and courage and not to become resentful and cruel because of it. That's your moral obligation. And I think I made a very strong case for that. I think I've been continually making a strong mm-hmm. case for that in my lectures and my books. And I don't see a more solid solution than that. It's okay to admit that it's unfair. I mean, obviously, what could be more obvious that the fact that there are these tremendous differences between people indicates a fundamental arbitrariness about the structure of being itself. And the question is, what do you do in the face of that? And the answer is, you bear your cross uphill. That's the answer.
You know who does this and speaks about this, and you maybe have met him, but if you haven't, I'm going to introduce you to him. My old boss, Clarence Thomas, in his book, My Grandfather's Journey, where this is like the whole book.
Uh-huh.
It was about, you know, he slept in a chair for the first, I think, 4 years of his life. He had no bed, and he had a pillow on a wooden chair. He had no, you know, his grandparents had to take him in because his mother had a lot of problems. And he was living in the South in Pinpoint, Georgia, dirt floor, dirt poor. And all the things he faced, all the things he went through, what his grandfather taught him, who was obviously lived in the segregated South, grew up there, dealt with all of this horrible discrimination. And he basically said, life lessons, Jordan, that were like this. And I say this to my kids, and they remember this. My son will say, I said, what's that in your hand? He said, that's my friend's lunchbox. I borrowed it from him. And then my other son, Dimitri, will say, don't ever take anything that's not yours from anybody, not even if it's a penny. Because that's what Justice Thomas's grandfather drilled into him as a young man. That, yeah, other people have more than you and always will, but don't you ever give away your power of your values and your morality and compromise your power. That compromises your own individual dignity and worth. Don't ever do that. And it stays with me.
Yes. Well, it compromises your integrity, and in this manner that has to be unpacked so that it's not a cliche.
Right.
It's like what you have to contend with the world is your integrity, and that's your honesty fundamentally, mm-hmm. and your honesty and your courage. And it isn't like the people on the left are incorrect when they point to the injustice of inequality. It's that the solution is not only untenable, but will necessarily make things far worse.
And much more divisive.
All of the radical leftist experiments in the 20th century indicated quite clearly that, well, first of all, that inequality wasn't a function of capitalism, which is an absolute leftist delusion. Why? To presume that inequality is something so easily explained away. And their solutions that were imposed made inequality far worse than it had been under the previous regimes. So, but it's not it's certainly not unreasonable to point out that inequality has this existentially painful quality.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and I think, you know, that's where we can end this today, is that again, you can feel for, and everyone feels for individuals who, they didn't get a fair start in life, they didn't get a fair shake in life, and they've dealt with enormous physical, health, socioeconomic problems, and continue to. But the solution is, you know, let's give everybody an opportunity to better themselves in a society that is orderly, safe, with safety, and where we don't encourage more, I think, division and resentment, which is what reparations. Next time we talk to you, Jordan, we're going to talk about the reparations push, which is growing in the United States.
Oh, yes, I saw that. That's it's absolutely insane. It's absolutely Elizabeth
Warren
should be terminally ashamed of herself. It's an absolutely appalling idea, but it's a logical outgrowth of the notion of identity, group identity as the fundamental identity. So black versus white, let's say, with whites in this situation being the perpetrator. I don't know how this is going to work in practically. I mean, what if your white ancestors were fought for the North in the Civil War? Does that give you a discount on the reparations?
No, you get no discount.
Is this just a general guilt that's shared by all people who are white? And how exactly are you going to define that? That it's such a nightmare. It's just a miracle to me that a negative miracle to me that this can be, that this idea can be being discussed by people who have serious political pretensions.
Jordan,
it's insane.
You know what my view is? My view is Elizabeth Warren. She has a lot of self-interest. She has a conflict of interest in this because she thinks somehow the indigenous people, the Native Americans, will also get reparations so she can jump on that bandwagon. So she gets the 1/1,000th, 12th% of all of this. Jordan Peterson, it's so great to talk to you. I can't wait to have you on the Ingram Angle when you're in New York. We'll work on that. And congratulations on all your success. You're a brainiac who's really, you made brainiacs cool, and thinking about all these extremely important issues, and so many young people have had their eyes opened by you. And just keep it up, and anything we can ever do for you, just let us know. Okay,
thank you. It's very nice talking with you
again. I want to thank all of our sponsors who are supporting this show: ADT Home Security, Genucel, and Pluto TV. We're not here if you're not here, and we love our sponsors, and we want you to love them and support them as well. Remember, this is the Laura Ingram Podcast, America now and forever. See you next time.